Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening.
I'm Will Campion and co-founder of the Money Maze podcast. And we're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is also a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker Bremont.
As we move into an era where the political, military, and economic dominance of the West is coming under pressure, the sense of uncertainty is unsettling. While we ponder where the next threat might come from, networks and connections are quietly being knitted together across the spine of Asia, or rather, they are being restored. The Silk Roads are rising again. Well, those are the closing lines of the majestic opus that is the Silk Roads, written in 2015 by my guest today. Described as one of the world's top 50 thinkers, a Sunday Times bestseller for the epic work Silk Roads, author of a piece in December 19 where he predicted a pandemic's likely arrival and what we need to do about it, but his day job is Professor of Global History at Oxford and Associate Director of the Programme for Silk Road Studies at Cambridge. And as impressively, he holds a double blue from Cambridge and Oxford and has played cricket for his country. So Peter Frankopan, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Lovely to see you, Simon. Thanks for having me. I'm a huge fan of the podcast, so I'm flattered and slightly intimidated.
It's a pleasure. I know that you're a good friend of Will Campion, who actually is the reason that we have this Money Maze podcast at all, since it was his inspiration. So I'll try not to let him down. So the plan today is for you to talk about your perspectives on the pandemic, what we can learn at looking at the world's changing order through a wider lens. Is globalization under threat? Interconnected supply chains? China, Asia, and the West all jockeying for position, the race for resources, Islam, Christianity, and how you reflect on the illiberalism developing at Western universities. So we should be able to run through that swiftly, and then we can talk about the T20 Cricket World Cup. So, Peter, how did growing up shape you?
Not talking or thinking about it too much. Lovely thinking about where you've come from, but we were all brought up to be told that you're only as good as your last essay. We weren't hothoused as kids. I'm one of five children, but we were all encouraged to stop and learn and think. My mother had done a PhD by the time she was in her early 20s in international law. So we were very bookish. We were taught to be quite curious, I think. And I grew up in a world that seemed to me very strange and alien and didn't have any reflection to the history syllabus or any of the syllabus I learned at school. I couldn't understand why half the things I was being taught, why I was being taught them. So I think in those days, people didn't travel very much. You know, at the end of the school holidays, we would all be fished out of schools and disappear over to Sweden or to Germany, Austria, and so on. And growing up with different kinds of voices, or languages too, was quite formative, I guess, in trying to make me think about the world. But the most important influence on me wasn't my parents. It was watching John Kramer's News Round as a boy, which is a TV program, a five-minute global roundup every day. And it covered things like climate change. It covered things like the revolution in Iran. It covered the end of the Vietnam War and the Khmer Rouge and a lot more, the PLO, etc., in bite sizes. And John Craven, distinguished broadcaster, I thought at the time was talking down to us all in a way that you'd explain complicated things to young people. But in a way, that sort of disappeared. There isn't a format like that so much anymore for the young. But for me, that was hugely important to think about the world in which I grew up. I'm a child of the Cold War, as you are, Simon, without revealing your age. So I grew up believing that the world would end in a nuclear catastrophe with the whole world in flames. And however bad things might look today, like your introduction said, we're probably better off than we were at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis in the 70s and even in the 80s. So I'm not here to tell everyone to have their glass half full, but a little bit of perspective doesn't hurt.
You get these degrees in Byzantine history from Jesus College, Cambridge, and a PhD from Corpus Christi, Oxford. I'm sure that there were any number of people from the Foreign Office, management consultants, investment banks who were then knocking on your door. But what was the motivation to go and lecture and specialize?
Well, I don't think it works like that. People don't come and knock on your door. I always assumed that they did. I guess I was slightly soft and thought that if you were either talented or thought you were talented, that the world owed you a living. And it was quite a shock to realize that that wasn't the case, that you've got to go make your own luck. I knew I wanted to carry on after my undergraduate career. And it was really a choice between working on pre-revolutionary and Soviet history or something much longer and deeper into Russia and the Middle East past, which is what I ended up doing. You kind of make your own luck, but it's not easy doing a PhD. It's not easy finding that every time you talk to your friends, you've got what academics call real jobs, but other people just call jobs. It's difficult to explain to them what it is you're doing and why. Is it a selfish, narcissistic signaling exercise to show how clever you are that you can pirouette about a topic that no one really is interested in? Or is there something more profound? And I think one of the challenges in academia is making sure that you can cross over to explain why what you're doing is important. And of course, in the UK, a lot of research is funded by the taxpayer. So I think one has to think about why one is doing it, what entitlement one has, and what responsibility you have if you're working on topics that seem to be slightly marginal. I've had conversations with ministers and cabinet ministers who've asked why on earth anybody would study the stuff I've done. And this was quite soon after 9/11. And I explained, I thought it's quite important that people can understand when the Quran was written, what it means, and how it's been interpreted. And that it's great to talk about STEM subjects and get funding into those, which is I'm all in favor of. But the humanities can sometimes go down a dead end of forgetting about what it is we're trying to do and how and why. Being of what used to be a marginal peripheral area of my subject, no one is interested in Eastern Mediterranean, Central Asia, Iran. I can tell you that for free. No one. You can count them on one hand, the number of people who work in those fields. When the world starts to change, as we're talking about today, it's quite hard to react because everything we over-rely on emotion because our level of knowledge is extremely low. And when you throw in China, South Asia, Southeast Asia, they're just not represented in school syllabuses. They're not taught at university. So finding a sort of starting point to engage with what's going on in the world today, it's really tricky.
Let's go to this pandemic, because you authored this piece in 2019, which was prophetic. Why did you write that? What was the inspiration?
Because I was asked into number 10 to come and advise about the challenges of the next 10 years. And I told them that was the number one priority. I told them the number two priority was lack of global response to pandemic disease.
Would you say that it was met with any great enthusiasm?
These things have been modeled before. There was a pandemic plan. There was a big handbook in the corner that they would smash the glass and open up and look at what would happen if things went wrong. I wasn't the only person thinking about it, but a lot of the work that I do is on mega trends. And so demographics, climate, and disease are the three major themes that I'm interested in work on. But also, you'll know that, and I'm sure many of your listeners, that the jump across from African swine flu and avian flus into the Chinese food system has been something that's been alarming people for a very long time. In a globalized world, it's inevitable that those pathways and connections that bring prosperity, trade, happiness, Justin Bieber, BTS, fashion, food, and etc., they also bring the negative sides. And some of that is disease. Cyber and other threats that we have are part of that ecosystem too. So I think it was just relatively fortuitous, but I was disappointed enough to think that having come out of Downing Street in December 2019, that I should probably write something about what we should be trying to do, preparing against pandemic by having alarm systems. Even now, we've had this great success at my own university here in developing AstraZeneca and the vaccines, but only 3% of biopharma funding goes into antivirals and into vaccine research, which is a very, very small amount of money given global spend on pharma. And possibly there are more joined up ways of thinking that we should probably learn from. And I suspect we almost certainly won't.
So let's just stay with that economic piece, because I think I'm right in saying that COVID barely makes it into the top 20 in historic pandemics. And yet the economic consequences have been akin to a major war. How do you reflect on that?
I think that it depends. If you're going to ask an economist, they'll show you the charts and tell you we're all catastrophized. If you speak to most people in the street, it's been negligible. The level of debt that's been generated or the money that's been printed by central banks, it is actually notional and has had zero impact on people's quality of life. I think if you walk down any high street in the developed world and you were to try to chart visibly what has been the impact of COVID, you'll see nothing that you'd expect to see with a pandemic. You won't hear protest music or people crying from the rooftops lamenting their lost ones. You won't find levels of hunger and poverty that are significantly different to how they were before the pandemic. In fact, inequality probably has risen rather than collapsed, which is what tends to happen in pandemics. So I think that in the grand scheme of things, we've got to be slightly careful to distinguish between something that feels like it's been strange, difficult, and awful between the realities. If COVID had killed on the same scale that the Spanish flu had killed in, we'd be looking at 270 million dead rather than 5 million adjusted for global populations. And those kinds of shocks deliver different kinds of things. When lots of people die, and particularly when young working people die, there are shocks to the labor force that produce economic impacts that are much more significant for society. In this one, it's been the opposite way around. There's been the swelling of the state is what we're going to see in the developed world. And that presents a whole different set of challenges because it means consolidation of powers by the center. It means the chancellor with much bigger muscles and much greater political ability to dip into the private sector, into the corporate world, much higher demands of what the state claims that it's trying to do. And that's also layered onto a changing security architecture right now where defense spending, the perceived threats and real threats mean that the state becomes much bigger. And when you already look at when we have pensions and health systems that we do, that looks very overweight to me in terms of what the capability is to keep the ship upright. And that's an obvious macro mega trend going on at the moment. We're announcing left, right, and center infrastructure deals in the US, building better and leveling up in the UK. As we're talking, Rishi Sunak is claiming he's going to rewire the entire financial architecture of the world. Those are big, big claims, which are almost certainly impossible to deliver on. But taking on more and more and more debts in the lowest common denominator means that the state becomes bigger and swollen. One doesn't need to be a specialist of the Soviet Union or of free market capitalism to recognize that the biggest challenge is the states are very bad at spending money. They're very bad at allocating. They're very bad at benchmarking. And politics drive economic decisions. And that's fine in a state like China because it's about political ideology. It's very unusual in places like Europe or the UK in particular, where we have a completely different view of what we think the state does to what it actually does. And that equation is going to get harder in the years to come.
I heard you talk at the Clifton Literary Festival recently. You reminded us that 75% of the world's population lives east of Istanbul. And you used a dramatic turn of phrase about the West. You said you stitch your eyes closed, essentially, from a Western perspective. And I wonder if you think we are excessively insular here, and I'm going to say the West broadly, and what are the consequences?
That entire world, east of Istanbul, from your side of the fence, that's called emerging market. Possibly China has its own separate category. But otherwise, all these countries fit in a basket, throw in all of Latin America, Central America, and Africa too. And it basically means people who aren't white or didn't colonize the world. So, you know, that has a first perspective problem from my point of view. Second is that it means that when we see people who will perhaps take different views on regulation, on ethics, with anything ranging from AI to machine learning, robotics, into genetics, that we're going to be operating at a world increasingly at two different speeds. And that presents problems. You've got to make a choice, which is you can run slower and treat it as a marathon. And as you remember from your Aesop's fables, the tortoise often wins. The problem is in different kinds of races, your lack of speed is a problem, in particular with the allocation of capital. And with capitalism, no one takes the long run. No one wants an investment manager who says we're going to be returning 2% when the peer set is effortlessly producing two or three or four times that level. Money flows into where those opportunities are. There is this world moving. It's not just an Asian world, it's an African world with population growth and climate opportunities as well as fractures coming. And we are bringing up generations of children, certainly in Europe and the UK and the US, with zero knowledge of these people's languages, their histories, their cultures, their people, their way of doing things. And funnily enough, most people have spent quite a long time studying us. So go to any street corner in the world and Tom Cruise is recognized, David Beckham or Prince William, but no one can name a Bollywood actor or a Nollywood actor or one of the top 20 singers in China. And so that is a form of neocolonialism in its own right. You're expecting everyone to come to us. And the more we say London is the best place to do business in the world and capital should flow here, the more we build up our vulnerability. States in the past, across different time, spaces and so on, become increasingly risky when they have lack of diversification. And we're so over-reliant on those financial services that it doesn't take much to knock those all down. Just as a case in point, 1914, the UK was the biggest creditor nation in the world. And 4 years later, it was the biggest debtor nation. And that collapse of government funding and debt made the American 20th century, because the prime beneficiaries of the UK's failure at that time, because of war and because of overexpansion on military, loss of life, etc., there was an immediate beneficiary that was the United States, with the energy, the breadth, the land, the agriculture, the openness towards some outsiders anyway at that time. The stronger we put our emphasis on a single sector, the greater our level of fragility. So we've stitched our eyes shut because we don't understand that in the first instance. We don't send young people out to discover other parts of the world. The sea trips, the Gojeks, the big unicorn companies in Indonesia are known to very few outside. And their costs of doing business are much higher. All of us want to invest into Tesla. In the last 2 years, the value of the automobile industry has gone up by $2 trillion, purely on the basis of money flowing into EVs. Evergrande, the big property investor, announced a couple of years ago it was going to do an EV division, had a valuation at its peak of $90 billion without having ever built a single vehicle. So the froth in the system presents fragility. So if we're disengaged from the needs, the demands, the consumption patterns of other parts of the world, it would seem to me that we're going to not be very good at making rational decisions when we work out what our opportunities are and what challenges come from there too. And that bar includes Russia, obviously, as well as China, but also Pakistan, Indonesia, Philippines, countries that don't get mentioned ever in any private office that I advise, in any corporate strategy group that I'm involved with, or let alone in governments. I was recently involved in something looking at the Pacific, and the only place that was mentioned in the Pacific was China, which has a Pacific coastline just about, but that's about it. And so that narrowing of perspective is really not helpful. And the world that I work in academically and beyond is all about trying to insist on seeing the bigger picture and not disappearing down silos, which is very tempting, very easy. And the echo chamber is very comfortable when you hear everybody saying the same thing, but it's extremely dangerous.
So I think I'm right in saying that you said something a few years ago along the lines of the sun rising in the east doesn't mean it's setting on the west. I may have paraphrased you. Do recent events make you reconsider that? In terms of, let's just take the Americans' withdrawal from Afghanistan, the confusion signals coming out, I guess starting with Obama about not being the Western policeman. But if you're sitting there leading the Chinese government or many of the others, you're playing the long game here and looking at what might be seen as a part of the world in decline, and that's working to your advantage.
I think that the dancing on the grave of the United States is not just premature, but completely ill-founded. The withdrawal from Afghanistan might have been done in a haphazard, chaotic, and amateur way, which tells you something important about the management structure of the Biden presidency. But one can entirely understand what the principle is, getting out of Afghanistan where there's no upside. One can see that saying, right, somebody else's problem from now on, that's a perfectly reasonable position to take. And I don't think that one can draw any conclusion about the fact that this shows that the United States is hunched on its knees and waiting for a knockout blow. I think the US has proved not only over the long term its resilience, has market opportunities, innovation, technologies, and a system that has its moment, as we saw on the 6th of January with Trump, but is in a different position to how we are in Europe, where we're consumers and increasingly not producers. The West needs to be now disaggregated into the US and into perspectives in Europe, and I include the UK in that. And one of the big challenges is that, as a friend of mine put it, in a world of carnivores, being a vegetarian may not be the safest option. And we're very good in Europe in trying to regulate. We're very good in trying to set up systems that are fair and equitable, but they're expensive. And the question will be, is that really capitalism, or is that a form of protectionism that becomes turgid, as happened in the Union or in China before the 90s? So I think one has to look very carefully at what one's talking about. But it would seem to me that those connections across Asia are really a fact of life. The embedding of supply chains, not just in China, but across Southeast Asia, mean that we are very, very heavily dependent. And although there's a lot of chatter in the security, intelligence, and military about decoupling, that process takes a long time. We're looking at time frames measuring decades. There was lots of excitement early this autumn about the US, Australia, and the UK won't be delivered for a couple of decades. The pace of change doesn't wait for that to happen. So it would seem that Asia's resilience will be based on whether governments can keep delivering rising levels of prosperity and economic growth. And that in the short term may be a challenge, particularly in China. But over the long run, if those countries don't, I think it's fair to say we're all doomed. So that coupling of the East and West rising together, if one side collapses and fails, then it's bad news for everybody. So it might well be that we're heading for a world of fracture, disaster, hyperinflation, catastrophe, famine, and so on. I'm sure books like that will sell lots of copies, But lots of things need to go wrong for that to happen. And on balance, one could take the view that however awful the world is for lots of different reasons, Uyghurs in Xinjiang, Afghanistan is not just a humanitarian crisis now with people starving over the winter. One could take the view that we could be doing a lot worse than we are. And despite the things going wrong, there's plenty that's going okay.
So let's just stay with China. For many of our listeners, they're asset allocators. The big question is China is rising both economically, that's obvious, but it's rising within the developing markets. Its equity weight within the emerging market index is rising sharply, even though it's a relatively new stock market. And so there's a lot of head scratching going on, as you all know, with allocators. But I just want to start with a historic question. And as I did some research for our conversation today, somebody reminded me that in the 1400s, China had owned the greatest seagoing fleet in the world, 3,500 ships, and it had been behind so many of the great inventions of gunpowder and paper and compass, etc. And the question posed is really, is there a reason that they cannot sustain this ascendancy?
It depends where you want to start, because we can talk about the 1400s, if you like. As John Micklethwaite put it from Ralph Bloomberg, the Chinese invented gunpowder and used it to make fireworks. We adopted gunpowder to kill each other on a massive scale. So when one talks about ascendancy, the biggest problem, I think, in the West is that we have an assumption that everyone is empire building. We have an assumption that everybody's out to colonize the world, enslave people, and behave the same way which we did. And there are good reasons to think that that's the hinterland that we come from, that we would expect that. But I think that that's a different story to understanding what it is that other people want. As it happens, Chinese diplomats, business people, the Politburo and beyond, are extremely insistent on reminding people around the world, particularly in Africa, but across Asia too, is that the Chinese weren't colonizers. And so when they come with checkbooks and attempts to invest or co-invest or to build infrastructure projects, partly as part of the Belt and Road Initiative, they keep coming and saying, we're here to win-win rather than to cut you off in chains across the Atlantic. And that's surprisingly compelling to lots of countries, because there's some truth in it, that that's not how the Chinese use their big naval fleets. So the question about now ascendancy is, despite the histrionics we sometimes hear in the West, China's not a rich country. It's got a big economy. It's gone up 15 times since it joined the WTO in 2000, more or less. Per capita income is about $10,000 a head, which is not wealthy. So the question would be, how does China grow and in what way? And what happens if it doesn't grow? And those, I think, are the trillion-dollar questions we should be asking. And I suspect we probably won't get too many answers in the next 20 minutes or so. A lot will depend on how you cut your cloth and what you think is happening, why you think it's happening. And China is on its own trajectory. We almost always over-insert the West into how we think China makes strategic decisions and political decisions and economic decisions. But it would seem to be that we should probably rethink that sometimes.
The short seller Jim Chanos had written some quite interesting stuff, and he made this comment, which was that he was alerted to what he would describe as Xi Jinping's growing bellicosity when one of his first speeches, he said he criticized the Soviet Union for having been too soft on perestroika, and his words were, they should have crushed it when they had the chance. Now, Taiwan is always in the discussions. I guess my question is, from a Chinese lens, how does the Taiwanese question get resolved?
Depends what your preferred outcome is. For sure, there are voices and people in the PLA who talk seriously about military occupation and not colonization, but of conquering Taiwan. There are voices that talk like that, and they demand high levels of budget for the Navy, Air Force, etc. So I think those should be taken very seriously. There's a lot of noise made, particularly by Xi Jinping, but by others too, about if a democratic solution doesn't exist, then a military one is inevitable. I suppose the primary question, which doesn't usually get asked, and certainly not in defense circles, is apart from banging the drum and talking about it, and I do acknowledge that it's a real threat and it's a real ambition, but the idea that people in mainland China don't sleep well at night because Taiwan is drifting in the Pacific and that tortures their souls may well be reasonable, but that's not a reason to make strategic decisions that could lead to nuclear war. I don't think the Chinese have any illusions that any attempt on Taiwan would lead to a massive US response. That's been concentrated in the minds of the US military over the last 18 months, maybe 24 months. And so for sure, there will be noises saying that that solidification of a defense network in Taiwan and of Taiwan's strategic allies will become harder and harder to crack. So if there's going to be anything, it should be sooner than later. But I can't see a scenario where that looks to me real, but it's in everybody's interests to make it look like it's real. And that itself can be the danger. So the problem is not about a Chinese amphibious assault on beaches that are difficult to crack. There are 14 beaches in Taiwan. They're all easily defendable. There's a great part of the American Navy on standby patrolling the Pacific. We just brought our own aircraft carrier it's on its way back now to Queen Elizabeth. So nothing's off the table. But the worry is when people start talking about war on both sides, that the military establishment and then above all politicians adopt a war footing. And those things can go wrong, and they do go wrong. The First World War starts because of the maneuvering, the posing, and suddenly something that nobody really wants becomes real. So it's not impossible, but I would assume that it's in China's interests domestically to talk about reunification with Taiwan as often as possible and as nationalistic way as possible to deflect from Evergrande and property bubbles, to deflect from lower economic growth. And we should probably be quite careful not to overread into it what we think might happen, but to rely more on what we think will happen.
Let's just shift tack to India, which often sits in the shadow from an asset allocator standpoint. I think Indian GDP per capita is less than $2,000 a head versus China's 10 and a bit. Where does India sit in this investing equation?
Well, that's the COVID story, the decimation of the middle classes in countries that haven't had a state that stepped in to pay for people to sit at home. The extent of how deep that cut is and how long it takes to recover should shape every kind of investment decision right now. I think that India, it's an unraveling story. We're over 1 billion doses that have been administered in India, but still COVID is obviously a major problem and a concern. But the short-term impact of COVID, I think it will depend on whether the coming out the tunnel is going to take 2 or 3 years and we see rapid growth, or something much, much longer. My own guess, and it is a guess, would be that the digital technologies that were already reshaping India in the last 3 or 4 years will accelerate now, as they have done in many other parts of the world. But Modi and his government are complicated. Modi hasn't given a single press conference since he became prime minister, never speaks to journalists, almost impossible to read, as is the case with Xi Jinping, likewise, doesn't take questions. And so a lot will depend on the political interventions, protections that have bedeviled India's growth in the past, where the bureaucracy is over elaborate, there are high levels of delays when it comes to decision making, and the infrastructure in India is improving, but it's still not competitive. So digital stuff will come past some of that. We've seen that with digital pay apps. We've seen that with the types of ways in which Flipkart and others have absolutely boomed. And so it'll be a test case to see whether India is able to run through the COVID problems. But it's a tough one to get right. People have presaged India's growth for a very long time. But India has its own problems, I think, geopolitically, not least with China, but also with its next door neighbors. Military junta in Burma is not helpful. Pakistan is a persistent problem. The issues with Iran, where India have been trying to play a grand strategic game, are challenging too. But the BJP's hold on power is, I think, something that needs to be thought through quite carefully. So one has to choose a sector in India with considerable caution, as one does in many parts of the world. But India hasn't, I think, delivered the same level of growth that it could and should have. And there are several reasons for that.
So let's change course and talk about education. I think none of us would dispute the fact that the future success of nations and growth in per capita GDP is going to be around good educational systems. You wrote in the Silk Roads about Timbuktu in that, I think, 200-year period where it sat in the middle of the Trans-Saharan caravan route and was both a trading and academic center. How do you think the global university landscape looks like in 20 years' time?
Generally, good scholarship and research is based on high levels of income. And that income can come from philanthropic donations, it can come from governments. But it's not a coincidence that the richest parts of the world have always tended to be the ones that lead in, particularly in the sciences, but in the humanities too. Old though my university is here in Oxford, we're 800 years old. 500 years ago, if you wanted the best scholars in the world, the best mathematicians, astronomers, philosophers, you didn't come to the Fens of Cambridge or to the Thames Valley. You'd go to Isfahan or Bukhara, Herat, and before that, Merv, Kaifeng, places no one's even heard of. So it's not unusual that off the path places like Oxford suddenly blossom. Now our biggest challenge is that Harvard's endowment is worth $35 billion and rising, and so is Yale. So you can buy talent, and that talent starts by being able to fund undergraduates, but above all, graduate students. So now at Yale, for example, all graduate students doing a PhD in history are fully funded with a living stipend. Mine will come with debts starting at already about 30,000 plus from undergraduate careers. By the time they've done their graduate degree and they paid their fees, living expenses, they're 100,000 down. So when students in the UK ask where they should go and study, Caltech, Stanford, Yale, Harvard, the big Ivy Leagues, and increasingly state universities in the US have resources that are incomparably high. So we need to work out how to hang on to our best students. At the moment, we do that by having outstanding research clusters. So people stay in Oxford or Cambridge or Imperial and St. Andrews, the other great universities in the UK. It's not just about Oxbridge, obviously. because there's networks of scholars who work here. But those things over time can get unpicked. There are universities in China that are offering $150,000 for newly qualified PhDs to come and teach, partly because no one wants to go and teach in central China, but the market will eventually correct all of that. So the challenge, I think, is how do we keep our Nobel Prize winning record? How do we keep it competitive in the face of very severe cuts to government funding? We've come out of the EU for good or for bad. In the case of the education sector, it's catastrophically bad because we don't collaborate as easily or as well with colleagues across the EU, both from funding, but also in just the very basic terms of being able to go and work in each other's countries, labs, etc. And the standards that are going to now shift in as well, as it's extra hurdles for us all. But if we can't keep finding the money, then things will drift. So Harvard 100 years ago wasn't a competitor to universities in Europe. Now it really is, if not ahead of us. So over the long run, it's all down to fundraising and to be able to prove and show your alumni, your donors, the state, what you're doing matters and why.
Do we underestimate the danger of this illiberalism that has been growing? It's been referred to as the Great Awakening, and the fact that free speech appears to be under assault, and you have to see it as an educationalist, a lecturer, a father of children. How do you process these quite powerful trends?
I think it's great that people have debates. I think it's great that these are all led by young people. And I think that they should have the freedom to be working out the parameters of what they think we should and shouldn't be able to talk about, in the same way that my generation, our generation, was keen on sexual equalities. And that was a big thing that the generation before us didn't really understand. And I don't have a problem with it at all. There's a lot written about it in the newspapers that makes it sound like it's much more serious than it really is. I've had zero experience of it ever in my career so far. We are not very good in outreach, particularly into different backgrounds, diversities. If you look across history faculties, we still have too many middle-aged white men. But on balance, the discussions about how we should be more inclusive is not hard to understand. And it's not hard to understand from a social point of view, also from an intellectual one. Every boardroom that you've ever been inside, the reasons you want to get out is when everybody agrees with each other and nods their heads. And normally that's because everybody looks like each other and they've all been to the same schools, universities, and so on. So diversity produces better outcomes. And there's a lot of research around that too, about bringing people with different perspectives. One of the things, again, with some of the people I advise, is that every big financial institution has something called a chief economist, but it might be more useful or as well to have a chief historian, that perspective that is reminding that the world that we look at, where data starts more or less with the Wall Street crash, is only exceptional in the context of the last 100 years. But look at over the longer term, these mega trends are easy to miss. So it's quite a long rambling answer, but I absolutely welcome, particularly young people, explaining what it is that they think their sensitivities are and trying to find the ways of solving it. And I think it's up to them to lead in the same way that generations before have worked out about sex before marriage or sexualities or religions. I think it's to be broadly welcomed by highly paid administrators and vice chancellors who've got to work out how to implement it. But some would say that if you're paid a lot of money to do your job, you should be good at being able to solve it. And some are clearly much better at it than others.
Right. I think it was Peter Harrison, the chief executive of Schroders, who was one of our early guests, and he made the point that it's neurodiversity that he wants on his board. And I think that as I've traveled around like you, one's seen various versions of that. But I think there is some confused thinking at board levels. I'd like to talk about religions. You wrote a long time ago in one of your books about Christianity had spread to Asia before Europe, and we have seen the power of the caliphates in the past. But how does this religious script unfold?
Slightly pedantic. It didn't spread to Asia. Christianity was born in Asia, despite what we might think, that Jerusalem and Nazareth and so on are somehow, they put them in snow globes, or that Jesus Christ, you know, must have spoken Latin because that's what the Pope says Mass in. Jesus Christ speaking Aramaic, Semitic language, and it's a fulfillment of Judaic prophecies, the arrival of the Messiah. So I think that those kinds of perspectives are one thing. For a discussion like this one, one can overemphasize people's beliefs, but one can also take them also for granted. Typically, when one talks about the Middle Ages, we assume that everybody was completely credulous, did what the fat monks told them to do, had no problem believing whatever they were told in a church. And there's no reason to think that our ancestors were any more stupid than we are, or that we are better informed. I think that's the challenge that the young will always face as well, of writing off people before as being stupid and narrow-minded. I think when it comes to things like caliphates, etc., states that are theocracies in the modern world as well as before, it's typically about consolidating political power and having a narrative. That's what history does. That's what a good analyst does. It explains why what's happening is happening. Normally, those narratives are a combination of hot air and make-believe. but because they're designed to be inclusive. They're designed to make everybody think there's a master plan. And disaggregation is what really matters. So again, as we've already been talking about, when you make a statement about 75% of the world's population living east of Istanbul, you then have to drill down into details. And that's the same thing when you look at religious worlds or theocracies of the Abbasid Caliphate or the Safavids in Persia, or at any form of political structure. It's that states, like businesses, exist to solve problems, like marriages exist to solve problems. And if you stop solving problems, or you're inefficient, or someone can do it better, then you fail. And assets get redistributed, reallocated. So it's not a surprise, I think, that things can sometimes go wrong and get replaced in the grand scheme.
You mentioned Russia earlier. I want to come back to that, because I was wondering, to what extent do you think that Russia and China's geopolitical interests collide?
I don't think they collide at all.
Even around the resource questions?
Russia wants markets. And given that people around Putin himself are heavily sanctioned and there's a lot of political opposition, it's not unreasonable to see that Russia will need to find other ways of bringing its resources to market, and China is a willing buyer. And in fact, the more compromised Russia is, the better for China. And the Russians know that. The more difficult it is to deal with Europe and the US, the better Beijing's negotiating position. And that's not something that plays down particularly well in Moscow, not surprisingly, because you want to have multiple buyers and multiple supporters. Russia has done this for hundreds of years, very good at playing a weak hand of cards well. But that's a very different setup and story to the world of China of the past and of the present, and I think the future.
And when you sit and think, is there something or a prediction that you feel is worth discussing that isn't on the table right now and may come from left field?
Yeah, I think there are lots of those. It's a very good question, but one catastrophizes very quickly when one starts to think about what could bring the House of Cards tumbling down. I've got my hit list of things that if I was writing my thought piece about what I think is going to go wrong. But again, fund managers want to hear what's going to go right. When you're investing, you want to think that there's upside rather than thinking on the edge of a disaster. The balance between resilience and fragility is a really important one to calibrate. And a lot will depend on the judgment of the individual and the individual's asset allocation, investment strategy, and also regional spread about where things are. But clearly right now, I'd have thought that hyperinflation is something which is real and existing. It's how long that takes to play through, how that's going to be addressed at a point where rates are what they are. But port congestion, resource shortage, mismatch of supply and demand would suggest that there's some immediate short-term problems that are likely to have relatively significant consequences, but they'll be different across different sectors and different countries, and they'll be addressed in different ways.
You advise a number of groups. Where are the areas that you are particularly keen to allocate capital?
Well, I think it's more about the pricing. The frothiness of anything which is tech or AI, it's thinking through what the upsides really are and what the competitive landscape looks like. So I can see asset bubbles almost everywhere that don't look to me that they're pinned on anything fundamental apart from goodwill, hope, and expectation. And that's always a difficult moment to be throwing money into. But big themes I look at are disease and disease prevention. What are likely to be the next pandemics, and how will they sweep, and how will they be different to this one? Looking at climate is a big area that I've been working on for the last few years and doing a lot on in terms of where those opportunities and fragilities are. And those flow into insurance through to resource prices and wheat and grain. And Russia is now producing its highest per bushel price of wheat for 40 years. And those change some of these things we're talking about. Demographics over the mid to longer term are, of course, going to be the driving factor behind climate. If we have a shrinking global population, then the way we burn things and consume things is going to change very dramatically, particularly as we have more and more old people who tend to spend their money more cautiously, and then they tend to pop their clogs. Some of the projections look like we're going to have population loss above 50% in most of Europe by the end of the century. And thinking through what that's going to mean if you're investing is really quite important right now. So I think it's not a blanket, here's the country, here's the sector. I think it's working through what happens in what order, in the assumption that we don't get hit by a meteorite or no one presses the big red button and starts a war. And those things could easily happen.
Given that one can't manage money always worrying about that exogenous shock, I want to just come back to China, because there's some fantastic valuations available with proper companies with sound balance sheets and free cash flow yields that are very tempting. Have you been discussing this, and have you been minded to allocate, given there's been a pretty decent setback in a lot of those underlying equities?
Yeah, I'm pretty bullish on China, partly because everyone else isn't. So the more bears there are, then that tells you something. It above all tells you that people don't know what they're talking about. In fact, it could be that the common prosperity that is on the move in China, the big new signature social economic policy announced by Xi Jinping in August of this year, making a lot more people moderately more wealthy, would seem to be not just a socially progressive thing to do, but a commercially quite interesting one too. One has to be careful that one's picking the right sectors in the country. But I think that we overreact and we jump very quickly on targeted and highly predictable ways in which the Chinese leadership has cracked down, perhaps a little bit more aggressively than some people have thought. But I think it was all coming from quite a long way away. The real estate sector, people have known for the last 5 years that 20% of properties are unoccupied, that the bubble is what it is. So the fact it suddenly pops, everyone throws their hands in the air going, who's going to get a haircut, would seem a case of surfing and of trying to complain about the waves when you've had a good run. So if you got in and out when the going was good, then fine. If you've been standing and now burnt, you can't really say that the property sector was something that was going to go on growing forever and ever. Those warning signs have been there, but it's easy to see and to convince yourself of the patterns you want to see. So no, I'm bullish on China. I'm bullish on Southeast Asia, particularly Vietnam and Malaysia, Singapore, Philippines, Indonesia. All of them look like that there's quite a good capacity for long-term growth. Countries like Mexico and Latin America, I'm doing an advisory group of senior ministers from across all of Latin America. And the kinds of things they're trying to do, it's really interesting that they're trying to work together towards developing socioeconomic policies, which is quite unusual. Normally, states try to do things one-on-one. The EU shows that it's difficult to make that work. But the appetite across almost all the Latin American countries that are involved in this, it's quite interesting that there's a real push towards being economically and socially progressive within the process of trying to make sure that economic growth delivers social mobility, which is one of the big problems in LATAM.
Well, I'm with you on China and have been seeking to add to my own investments there. Peter, you have a terrific podcast. It's called I've Been Thinking. I have listened to a lot of them, particularly the recent one on supply chains and art fraud. And I'd encourage any of our listeners, and we'll put it in our show notes, to listen to it. But as a podcaster, what does the podcast give you that you didn't have before?
The biggest problem, I think, in academia and of being in the investment world is that you become a specialist quite early and you stick with your specialism. Once you start working on oil markets or natural resources, then you're stuck there unless the winds blow and you take a risky job somewhere else and you suddenly do something different. But I think one of the big excitements and challenges is carrying on reading and carrying on thinking. So, you know, I've been doing quite a lot on lateral stuff. We've had 2 years locked up inside. So that's a great opportunity to spread one's wings, looking at things like bank robberies in LA in the 1980s and 90s and correlations with cocaine usage and also the availability of high-grade freeways that bank robbers could escape to and how did that get cracked down. At one point, it was 5,000 bank robberies per year. I think reading through and reading around subjects and going into topics like prison and its communicative diseases, prisons are the worst single place for spreading disease, therefore, how does one try to calibrate social problems? So what the podcast does is it gives me an outlet for some of the stuff that I'm reading, thinking about, and trying to slot into kind of megatrend work that I'm interested in for other reasons, and showcasing really exciting work that's being done often by friends of mine or by colleagues of mine, and to talk to them about what they're doing. So I just did a podcast on remittances. And so when we think about immigration is probably the single most decisive thing in elections at the moment in the developed world, certainly in Europe, the UK, and the US. If you have a loose immigration policy or lax immigration policy, you get voted out of office. But the more immigrants you get coming into your country, the more you're improving democracy globally. So the amount of remittances of money sent back to host countries is used to shape and seed businesses. It's used to demand political activism and political voices. It's used as counterbalance to authoritarian regimes. And you can track that. It's much more efficient, in fact, than spending development money spent by the taxpayer. As I said, government's not very good at spending tax money. So that idea about how we should be thinking about improving levels of governmental transparency and social democracy in authoritarian states is very closely linked to how we treat people who come here and how we help them send money back to their host countries that gets people out of poverty as well as the commercial, social and political stuff. So things like that, it's great to get a chance to let them talk about their work and let you ask terrific questions and be able to have a way of trying to bring in some of the things that are either directly things I'm working on or things I've been thinking about.
So I'd like to close with a few general questions. We have quite an important cohort of students who listen to this, and we do talk about and we ask our guests about career advice. And given your perspective geographically as well as content-wise, what advice, general advice, would you give to students thinking about where and how they should plot their post-university early days?
I think the big difference to when we were young is that now there's an expectation that when you enter the workforce, you're going to be jumping around from sector to sector and company to company. And you might go and train to be an accountant and then become the FD of an internet startup or something that looks at any form of business that you have got no particular skill in. What I've learned and the thing I'd encourage is to not think about education as something that either stops when you finish school and university, but also to not think of education or learning as something you do in the office. So exposing yourself to other parts of the world through looking, learning, reading is something that should carry on for the rest of your life. It's amazing that people don't sort of seem to think that or realize that. I've spoken to you about that before, Simon, that with our kids, we force them to listen to Korean rap or Hungarian hip hop for every 10 of their songs they want to listen to. In a world where digital commodities are basically free, not quite, but there's no reason why you can't be watching films being made in West Africa on Netflix or things in different languages or listening to music, reading the newspaper from Peru or New Zealand or Lesotho. The problem is no one does because no one tells them they should. So my advice to students is don't wait for someone to tell you to do it. Because as we started the podcast, no one comes and knocks on your door and headhunts you. No one comes and asks if you like something. You've got to make your own luck. And you'll only do that, I think, if you go after things you're interested in yourself and then find a way and see if you can make those things work. As it happens, no one cared what I was working on 15 years ago, but through the chance of writing a book that got picked up and going to number one in the UK, in China, in India, or New York Times bestseller, that suddenly meant that people were much more interested. So when the knock does come, I was lucky I wasn't a 23-year-old whippersnapper trying to show off. I was already in my 40s, four kids, and trying to make an honest living. I think that for young people, it's about constantly accumulating more knowledge and ideally things that other people don't already know about. So it's finding outlets that you can accumulate and gather information and think about it and to try to step into worlds that perhaps you haven't been introduced before, which feels scary.
You yourself have achieved a terrific amount so far. What challenges do you want to undertake in the next decade?
The bits that I find most rewarding are where you find either least resistance or best outcomes. And typically those tend to be around military and in defense with corporations that need to respond quickly to changing global worlds, where not only people want to talk and listen and think about it, but actually go on and act and influencing policy. I'm very happy going to give lectures to my colleagues in universities around the world. I love doing that. And I love hearing my other brilliant colleagues talk to me. And I had yesterday something on the consequences of pandemic disease on the Gold Horde north of the Black Sea in the 1340s. Which was absolutely terrific, spellbindingly good, from a colleague at Kazan University. I think it's finding ways in which smart ideas can actually move the needle. And I've been very lucky timing-wise with things like pandemic. It's got me into rooms of discussion. I've been at stuff in Central Asia 5, 6, 7 years ago where it's heads of states, foreign ministers, members of the Politburo, and I'm the only European in the room. I remember sitting there one evening, one event that I'd done, and I was there with a guy called Fred Starr, who was behind the US policy around a lot of Central Asia at the first part of the 21st century. And he said, what do you want to do next? And I said, I just want to be on the team sheet for next year. I just want to be invited back and not people to say, we thought that guy was smart. Turns out he's a little bit overrated. And he said, look, you've spent 30 years doing sit-ups, going to the gym, getting ready for this, and you're here for a reason. So that imposter syndrome, you've got to recognize that actually when people ask you what they should do, they're going to listen to it. So I wrote some of the post-pandemic economic recovery plan for China, Pakistan, Mongolia, the 5 Central Asian republics, and Afghanistan, and chaired a meeting of ministers from those countries last year. So working on a big plan of how to reduce some of the overheads and costs that does change people's lives. So it's having access to those kinds of discussions, being able to shape policy and then seeing them through. So this particular program I'm working on was going to add before COVID would have made a big difference. Arguably, it will make even more of a difference because the heart's been taken out of a lot of economies that haven't had rich governments to pay people to sit at home.
So being on the team sheet brings me full circle back to cricket. You played cricket for Croatia. Tell me, what is it about cricket that you treasure most?
I'll tell you what I treasure most is that I used to love sport. And then I met and fell in love with my wife very young. She's very sporty, as you know. And I didn't play cricket for 15 years or maybe more. And then through a sort of sequence of misunderstandings that you've been very kind to help perpetuate, makes it sound like I'm much, much better at cricket than I really am. So I'm incredibly grateful. So I got roped into a team of authors who play cricket and Sebastian Folkes, Tom Holland, Charlie Campbell, Benny McGowan and so on, who all were once upon a time quite handy. It's a brutal, terrible game because it's unforgiving. You're out first ball and the sulk. But as my wife often reminds me when I come home complaining, She says, would you rather be working on your footnotes or on a plane somewhere? And the answer to that is almost always no. But I do like playing sport, partly because it makes me think that I'm still 18. And sadly, when I look at myself in the mirror, I realize that I'm not. So it's basically living vicariously and talking about cricket very earnestly, my batting average, as though I was playing in the T20 World Cup, which, for reasons that I don't quite understand, I wasn't chosen for.
Well, as we said at the beginning, I too am a devoted cricketer. I'm older than you, and I got roped into a side called the Old Saw But Keens. And when the mail came through, it actually was Old Saw But Keen. So that just goes to show how desperately short the world is of bowlers with a 50 on their age. Peter, it's been absolutely terrific. I have taken away such a lot, and our listeners will as well. And your writing is great. Your thinking is great. Your speaking is so clear. Two particular things I am going to take on board from an investing standpoint. The current narrative has a strong anti-China flavor, and yet, as we've said on the show before, there is a really compelling investment opportunity there if you can get yourself comfortable with the right allocations. But just turning away from that area seems ill-advised. Vietnam in particular, you picked up before in your writings, and I absolutely get that. And just general advice, and it's not just for young, although you were targeting it young, and that is keep learning. And when we're all supposed to live to 100 years old, perhaps that's never been more important. So Peter Frankopan, lovely to have you here today. Thank you so much for giving us your time.
Thanks, Simon. Thank you, Will, for roping me in. Hope to come back again soon.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.